From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the final episode for the iTunes feed of 2015 of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am your host, Mr. Hunter Dusing, and with me today in the darkened noir streets of Los Angeles is Mr. Stuart Bulk. Say hello, Stuart.
I have a concussion. I can't be on the show today.
Oh, okay.
My mother said it's not right.
I gotcha. Did you get a concussion in the pit at the AC/DC show?
Now, this is more of a case of falling over, you know, like walkers and wheelchairs and shit from the old people.
all wearing devil horn caps.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
And that other voice you hear is our friend from Colorado. Here with us in the darkened streets of Los Angeles, Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Yeah, I somewhat confused with Hunter on many of these episodes by some of our listeners for some reason.
Yeah, really, like you can't work it out, but whatever.
Yeah, apparently.
I don't understand that. I don't think we sound at all alike.
No, really.
We don't really talk alike either. So.
I think that's like confusing me and Stuart. Like it just. I'm not saying you sound Australian. You have a crazy accent or anything. I just think we don't sound anything alike, you know.
No, I don't see it either. Actually, just yeah, I've got the one.
Did you say that? Are they from a foreign country?
No, it's like people from the coast. Maybe it's because we both use Mid-Atlantic accents for the most part.
That could be because you know I listen to some shows from the UK and. It takes me a little bit to distinguish who the two people talking are.
True.
And I'm like, you know, I'm sure they would think that's crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I haven't figured out the nuances between the way they talk. Maybe it's we're both from the Midwest. Maybe, you know, there are some little similarities there that people have trouble distinguishing. But I don't know. Yeah.
I'm okay.
That's true. Stuart knows. So, what's your excuse? Right. Huh? He's from Australia.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah. So, fuck AC/DC. All I can say at the moment, this is causing gridlock everywhere around fucking town.
Yeah, the boys from your hometown heroes, they're like it's like the president coming to visit in one of our towns.
Oh, it really is like the Pope in the Batmobile, actually, in there through the streets of Venice or wherever the Pope's from, someplace in Italy. Vatican City, yeah, same place. Yeah, it's like the returning hometown. I did see a guy actually. What was pretty cool in that store I was telling you guys about off air before the show was. A guy had a T-shirt of Malcolm Young. I thought, that's pretty cool. Not many people do that. I mean, obviously he's done now once he's now in a nursing home and can't
remember. Yeah, I was about to say, now that Malcolm's sort of the fallen hero of the band, you know, after Scott, you know.
Yeah, really. But, I mean, I thought that was pretty cool. But I didn't tell him because I was too busy living my happy days.
By the way,
seasons.
John absolutely ruined Rock or Bust for me. Because I was like,
what, AC/DC didn't do that for you enough?
Well, I thought it was pretty
the album
fun
itself.
Record.
Yeah.
And John goes, it sounds like bro country to me. And then I was listening to that one of the songs on there, like Rock the Blues Away, and I was like, holy shit, he's right.
Yeah. I only listened to it once, and I said they must be aiming at the bro country market.
I was like, oh my god, he's right. It sounds like bro country, and I haven't listened to it.
Yeah.
Oh my god, he's right.
I'm not that fond of it. It's like, yeah, it's a one-time listen, like John said. That's it for me. One time, I'm done. I don't need to hear it again.
Black Ice was better, you know?
Way better.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, but when John said that, it just, I went, when, the next time I listened to it, I just heard, and it sounds like bro country. And I was like sitting there listening to it, and I was like, yeah, it does. Shit. Yeah. I mean, it's not on the nose. Like, it doesn't sound like Florida Georgia Line, but it's enough to where when that suggestion was put in my brain, it just fucked it up, you know?
I've got a better way around that, Hunter, for future things that you actually like. Just don't talk to John about it because he's bound to ruin it some way or another. Yeah. You're like, it sounds like this, or it seems like this. I'm like, shit, he's ruined it again.
He has that ability. He has not the Midas touch, but the Shidas touch.
Yeah, you have that.
Everything he touches turns to shit.
Yeah,
all I gotta do is tell you what you don't want to hear about something you like.
He's like, John's the best critic in that he taps into that thing that you haven't realized yet that would make you hate something.
No, it's nothing to do with that. It's just a fact. John has to see somebody happy. That's all. He's like, I'm going to fuck this person up.
You might be right.
Yeah.
I see somebody enjoying something. Let me fix that.
Yeah. Let me put this comment here, post. Okay, that's it. My day's done.
Well boy, am I going to ruin a long beloved pop hit tonight on this show.
Oh, boy.
For everybody.
Can't wait.
John, why don't you explain this show that we're doing, it's kind of in the vein of our Who Killed Superman show.
Yeah.
Which is getting a replay over at the Phantom Sway the week we're recording this. But which was our show about George Reeves and Superman. But this is – why don't you explain the topic, John, because you came up with this.
My idea was, well, there's all these really awful true crime stories in Hollywood about things people like. There's always the well-known ones, George Reeves, Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, Victor Salva, you know, just any – it's, you know, usually involving molestation or murder or who was it? Lana Turner's daughter that killed – her husband and stuff. You know, just
Marlon Brando's son.
You know what's
right.
You know what's a story that I've been hearing on a lot of podcasts lately? For some reason, this story recently has gone kind of viral in a minor sense. Is
Eurons?
That one too. But the one we did the show on, because all of a sudden that's popping up everywhere. But Lionel Atwill. Mm-hmm.
Jesus, the old 30s actor?
Yeah, the Lionel Atwill.
From the Universal Horrors.
Yeah, he was in Son of Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah.
He was an actor, but he also was a orgy master.
Jesus.
Yeah, he also hosted these crazy Hollywood orgies, and there was some girl who brought it to trial. I don't know, but there was this story about that I heard about it on a podcast, and then I heard it on another podcast and another podcast. Like, it was really weird. Like, yeah. I started hearing this Lionel Atwill : orgy master story.
That's why they had that movie, the Orgy of Frankenstein.
Yeah, the Orgy of Frankenstein. Directed, was that Ed Wood or something?
Oh,
was
possibly.
Orgy of the Dead. He did Orgy of the Dead, and Jess Franco did Erotic Rites of Frankenstein.
Yeah, there was some. There was this.
Flesh for Frankenstein as well.
Yeah, Flesh for Frankenstein.
Yeah.
But Lionel Atwill, it says on Wikipedia, he was indicted with perjury by a jury investigating a 1941 proceeding of a grand jury relative to an alleged occurrence of a orgy at his home.
Some of the things I've looked at over the years, and some things that I've read. I mean. Everyone seemed to think Hollywood was squeaky clean back in the 40s. It was not. It was probably more decadent then than it is now.
In fact, the story I picked is mostly about the control of Hollywood's image and sort of the cracks appearing in that in a case. But
it was alluded to in the Hollywoodland film we reviewed for They Killed Superman as well.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Definitely.
Because it's kind of funny because there's this sort of sheen and underbelly to classic Hollywood, the dark underbelly and all that. But at the same time, like, I do get on Facebook and go, I look at interviews Daniel Craig does about Bond, and I go, I wish Hollywood controlled its stars like it used to, because
I know.
like one of the reasons it took me so long to go see Spectre was because Daniel Craig was being such a fucking bummer in the press about it. I was like, yeah. back in the classic Hollywood era, you would not be allowed to talk about a movie like that.
No way.
You just couldn't do it. They would blacklist you.
And the interesting thing is the product was more consistently better.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I've always had people argue with me, but Bogart couldn't pick his own roles. And I go, but consistently, look at the output. The movies were better. I mean, just better.
Like,
even
John
the
Wayne movies are so consistent. Like, when he got his stride going, so consistent. Bogart, consistent. Yeah. You know, like, you look at this stuff, and today, these days in Hollywood, it's like they're complete retards when it comes to creative formulas.
Yeah, they are.
Hey, real quick question. It got me thinking, now we're talking about old Hollywood. Do they have still actors contracted to a studio like they did back then or not?
No, I didn't think so.
They all freelance now. They might do a 2 or 3 picture deal with a studio, but it doesn't look like a lot of actors actually sign it. Like, they don't even bother.
The last person I can think of who was probably contracted to a studio was Clint Eastwood with Warner Brothers.
Ed Norton was contracted with Paramount and supposedly did the Italian Job for almost nothing because he just wanted to get out of his contract.
Right.
And
okay.
then he became a direct-to-video star because he puts out all these movies that go straight to video that nobody ever sees.
Well, and it's because he has a reputation for being difficult to work with.
Yeah.
Like there's a reason Marvel wouldn't recast Mark Ruffalo as the Hulk, you know, because they said, you know, Norton was a pain in the ass to work with. Incredible.
Yeah.
He wouldn't do press for the movie, if you'll recall. Like, he refused because he hated the film.
Yeah.
That's how I blame him. It's not that good, really.
No, it's not. And he said they cut out all the good stuff that he wrote for the movie. That was his excuse.
No, right. But, yeah, so that was my question. Just curious. I didn't think that was the case anymore because a lot of things you heard, this one was contracted to Paramount, and this one was contracted to Fox, and you don't hear that no more, you know?
Nope.
No, they won't do it. They just absolutely will not. They won't sign those deals.
Okay.
Do directors do that, though? Because I've heard directors going like, oh, 3-picture deal or something, but it almost never, like, it's like if the first one bombs, they go, you know.
Right. Studios sign with an option to drop it if the first film flops.
Okay.
It's like, you know, they could put it, what do they call, turnaround or something, or the contract becomes open or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you can go work for another studio. We don't care.
I think Woody Allen was signed to United Artists for years in his early career.
He was, he had a really good relationship with United Artists, and it was just because he consistently delivered the kind of movie they wanted. You know?
Yeah.
There's right. the book, The Final Cut, which is about the making of Heaven's Gate. It's not just about Heaven's Gate. It has a lot of interesting history of United Artists and their relationships with actors and filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into detail about Woody Allen.
Well, Woody Allen's films were cheap, shot quick.
Yeah.
There was never any drama on the set. It was just like, you know, Ian, you listen to Woody, get the work done, you're out.
I mean, Woody's like, what, 80 years old? Just a few, like this week, I think. And he still puts out a movie every year, you know.
Yeah.
He's actually the most prolific director in the movies today.
Yeah. I think, even at his age, he still puts out a movie every year like clockwork.
And in the 70s, when he was making films for United Artists, those were popular everywhere. Now he just kind of makes movies for the Woody Allen audience. But back then, those movies did really well.
Although, occasionally, you get a Midnight in Paris that becomes a huge hit, you know, like, Midnight in Paris was a big hit for Woody. You know, that was like, I think that was one of his biggest.
So was Match Point as well.
Yeah, Match Point was like occasionally he has a hit, you know, like I think once every 10 years, you know. Like, because Midnight Paris, that was like, they said that was like Woody's biggest movie to date or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not as good as his old ones. His older ones were way better.
No, you can see why people like it because they like it kind of appeals to that sort of college crowd that the movie's critical of.
Yeah.
The movie, like, if you watch Midnight in Paris, it's making fun of people who are nostalgic for an era they didn't experience. And the movie appeals to people who are nostalgic for eras they didn't experience.
Oh, I'll have to see it. I think it's on Hulu. right now or something.
I like it. I enjoy it quite a bit.
I can't think of the last Woody Allen film I watched. I mean, of his latest stuff, I really don't know.
Did you see the Jasmine, Blue Jasmine, or whatever it was?
I saw Blue Jasmine. That was the last one I've seen.
The best thing about it was Dice. So.
Dice was great.
Yeah. Your son's working in a guitar shop in Oakland?
He didn't want me to say nothing.
What was the one he did in the 90s with the gangster one with Chaz Palminteri? It was a
Bullets Over Broadway.
Bullets Over Broadway. That was good. I remember enjoying that one a lot.
I'm one of the only few that likes Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
I thought it was okay. I wasn't.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty. I thought it was fine.
It was a throwback to the Bob Hope ripoffs.
It was. Woody said that was sort of his love letter to those movies he grew up watching.
Right. Is that the one where they had to dig a tunnel or something?
There was a big hypnosis gag. It was him and Helen Hunt, that
jazz guitar, like dun 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 dun, dun. Yeah. You get hypnotized. I don't know.
We've been talking about Woody Allen enough, but he is sort of pertinent to.
He's a scandalous character, and we're going to talk about scandal, murder, and all that rape and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Good way to finish off the year, folks, isn't it?
Yeah.
Murder and rape.
Happy holidays.
Yeah. A bit like that Steve Martin thing he does when he's playing the banjo. He goes, you can't be angry when you're playing the banjo. You can't make anybody sad when you're playing the banjo. He goes, death and murder and rape. He's playing the banjo. Have you seen that bit? It's all Saturday Night Live skit he did back in the 70s.
That's funny.
It's funnier when you actually watch it. Opposed to me saying it, he's
the guy that brought the ratings to Saturday Night Live when he'd host.
Oh, he was fucking hysterical on that show. He was absolutely hysterical on the show. I don't know what happened after that.
Pretentious.
Yeah, depression as well, and a dislike of everybody on the planet as well probably doesn't help. And reclusive, reclusiveness doesn't help much. And well, speaking of that. Real quick, I just started reading Nikki Sixx's The Heroin Diaries. Oh, God. The man should be dead. Should be dead. Oh, my goodness.
I'm still cracking up over Sully Erna calling him a cocksucker on the Justice podcast. He was like, that guy's the biggest piece of shit I've ever met.
Yeah.
He's such a cocksucker. That guy, you're fat, you're old, you're irrelevant. Why are you acting like a rock star, huh?
I tell you, somebody who could go toe to toe with Nikki Sixx and drugs was Vanity. Apparently, from what I've been reading in the book.
Oh Jesus!
Oh yeah. God, she was a crack whore to fucking say the least. You know.
You know who else did Scott Weiland? How'd that turn out?
Well, yeah. You know, his clock was ticking. Man, he was like on a doomsday clock. That guy.
Yep.
He's.
By the way, it's so funny. Like, you know, whenever somebody famous dies, you always see the sort of reverence on social media.
Yeah, really.
Scott Weiland died. Everybody was making fun of him.
Yeah. Like, no, you know,
people burp like cooking heroin in spoons, and it said candlelight vigil for Scott Weiland.
Jesus.
Because you know he never stopped. It's just like
he never learned. No, he never.
You know, he ran away from rehab and he was doing junk again. It was like. He was a chronic failure. He never had any accomplishments.
Band together like Stone Temple Pilots. You know, he couldn't keep Velvet Revolver together.
Nah.
And you know, just he never did anything that was that great.
No,
honestly, basically, like Stone Temple Pilots, like what? Plush.
I never liked him.
What?
I never liked anything he really did.
Velvet Revolver, I do think, was better than anything Axl's done with Guns N' Roses. But
they were more like a throwback to sort of 70s. Rock sound.
To me, they were Guns N' Roses with Scott instead of Axl. They just traded another crazy fuckhead for.
When I saw them live on their first tour, they basically just did Guns N' Roses and Stone Temple Pilots songs.
Yeah,
and the thing was, is their album. What they could have done those songs. I mean, those were good songs.
No, well, they did those songs, but that's only about a half hour of material. So they did a lot of Guns N' Roses and a lot of Stone Temple Pilots tunes, and then they did like a. a Sex Pistols cover.
And what was it? I remember reading this piece where they were talking about, you know, the Velvet Revolver and what would happen if they – what since they're all famous members of other bands. And they were like Slash said, well, you know, we might lose Scott if there's ever a Stone Temple Pilots reunion, but, you know, who the hell wants that to happen? Like, I mean, all of them were like, well, you know, the Guns N' Roses fear of them – of Guns N' Roses getting back together is legitimate, but Stone Temple Pilots, who cares?
Yeah.
They
get back together, though, and nobody cares.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, really.
And then they got Chester Bennington from Linkin Park.
Well, there's a fail right there. Linkin Park, yeah.
Although Scott Weiland has one really good thing is his first solo record. It's like a Bowie ripoff album. You can find it in any dollar bin, but it's actually pretty good. It's like he always wanted to be a David Bowie type. It came out like 98, 97.
Okay, because I know he put out that Scott Weiland and the Wildabouts thing recently. But.
Yeah, this was called Bar Blues, and it was basically just trying to throwback to like the Bowie of Station to Station and the Bronson stuff.
So when Bowie was doing the most cocaine, basically.
When Bowie was listenable, I would say. And you would actually go back and listen to the CD again or listen to the album again and again, you know.
I love the Melvins cover of Station to Station.
I haven't heard it.
It's amazing. Have you heard
Lard's 70s Rock Must Die that came out a few years ago? Yeah, it's a good track, yeah. It's only an EP, but it's pretty good still. I liked it. I dig Lard. They're pretty good. But anyway.
Okay, but let's get into our topic. So, John, our topic was basically we're going to bring salacious Hollywood stories, murder, rape, extortion, criminality, to the darkened streets of Los Angeles, the city of angels, the devils. Yeah.
Well, this will probably only be remembered by people who remember the 70s, and which means our older listeners. But mine was about the director Joseph Brooks, who started his career as a commercial jingle writer and made a fortune writing jingles for commercials back in the 60s and 70s. And he took that money and financed his own movie called You Light Up My Life. And, of course, wrote that title song, which was going to be the big, you would tie in the single with the movie release to kind of promote it on the radio. And so he finances this low-budget film, his Didi Khan playing the character. I haven't seen the film. I've only seen bits and pieces of it. And I remember the ads in 1977. You could not get away from them. I don't know what it was like for Stu in Australia, but in America, for some reason, Columbia Pictures picks up this movie, this independent production or self-financed movie by director Joseph Brooks. And it's just about some showbiz girl who she decides to become a singer instead of a comedian. And it's really just supposed to be one of those small budget dramas that would, you know, play in a few theaters and then get dumped on television. Well, apparently Columbia thought they could make a fortune off of it. So they did coast to coast saturation with the film, but nowadays it means nothing. I brought this up on on the show before, but you know, in the old days, it used to be movies were four-walled or regionally released around the country. And when you saturated, it was because you wanted to make as much money as you could before word of mouth got out.
As quick as possible. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Just get the money. Cause you're going to be closing a week, but it was released all over the country. And back then that was unique. So they just said, okay, we're going to squeeze some money out of this because we got a potential hit song. So, meanwhile, in the film, it's a session singer singing the song that's dubbed over Didi Khan. And that's what you hear in the movie. Now, when they decided to do the record release, apparently director Joseph Brooks, who also wrote the tune, when he was producing the single, he hit on the singer of the film version. So she rejected his advances and later had to sue to get royalties for, you know, her work in the film. So he decided to record a different version that would be released as a single sung by Debbie Boone. That became the big monster hit on the radio.
Yeah, so I remember the Debbie Boone one. Yeah.
Drive you crazy. And so movie opens, does really well for a couple of weeks, and then word of mouth gets around, this movie kind of blows. So it's kind of done. By then, they've already made their money off this low-budget film. He then does another film where Joseph Brooks, who is not a trained actor, decides to star in a film that's sort of like a romantic get-your-lover-back type movie with Shelley Hack. It's called If I Ever See You Again. And it bombs hideously. One problem is Joseph Brooks cannot act. He has a stutter. So he's in this film as the lead. And you can see it on YouTube.
Is he like the 70s sort of Tommy Wiseau, is he?
Yeah, actually, it's a good comparison. It's pretty apt because he has no business starring in a film. And, oh, I should add that You Light Up My Life also won an Oscar in 1978 for best original song. So he had an Oscar for his shelf. So he makes this movie, If I Ever See You Again. It's a massive flop. It's barely released. I think there was a video release, which is where the YouTube version comes from. Or no, actually, they taped it off HBO. I'm sorry, because there's an HBO logo in the beginning. But it had a brief videotape release. But there is a rumor out there that Shelley Hack hated her performance in the film so much, she bought the rights to it and shelved it. And, you know, later she was on Charlie's Angels. I think she was one of the replacements for Farrah Fawcett, and she made some money on television. It's a bad movie. It like sums up the worst of like late 70s major studio cinema, especially for an egomaniac like Joseph Brooks. So he marries a Playboy model, has a couple of kids. He later finances a film that is somehow had John Gielgud in the movie playing a Southerner. Or something like not doing a British accent. And
now look, John Gielgud wasn't hard to get. It's just an endless supply of cock for him, and he was seen in any film.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Because then the story gets like he does some other films. He even does a film in like 1999 that was never released anywhere. Although there's an IMDb listing for it, but it's never been released. And then he apparently lived in New York in some penthouse. After a divorce, and his two kids lived with his ex-wife, and later he got custody of the kids, and this will come in handy later, but he's like a major or massive client with one of the New York madams, like hiring prostitutes and such. But anyway, he started running a scam where he would place ads in Craigslist looking for actresses, and he had a female assistant who would set up the arrangements and stuff, and he would have auditions in his penthouse apartment, and he would rape them.
Jesus. And good Christ.
Yeah. And this is like a successful serial raping thing he was doing. According to – I'm going to have to look on the Wikipedia to get the numbers accurate because I don't want to exaggerate. But, okay, he was indicted in 2009. He was arrested on charges of raping and sexually assaulting 11 women lured to his East Side apartment from 2005 to 2008.
Good God.
Yes, and before he could go to trial, he committed suicide. Now, listen to the suicide. May 22nd, 2011, found dead in his Upper East Side condominium apartment by a friend arriving for a lunch date. Brooks was found with a plastic bag over his head near a hose attached to a helium tank with a suicide note found nearby. It's like, according to law enforcement sources, in the note, Brooks claimed he would be exonerated of charges pending against him, but complained about his failing health and a woman who he claimed had abused him and taken his money. And this is the other odd, really odd thing. His son, before the suicide, was convicted of killing his girlfriend and got 25 years to life in New York. And his son kind of grew up as a spoiled rich brat, dating like a I think she was like a swimsuit designer, and he murdered her. So his son ended up being a killer, and he was like this serial rapist. And of course, his horrible egomaniacal film is on YouTube. It's up to you to decide which is the worst crime. But he also gave the world You Light Up My Life, which is also a crime against humanity.
Yeah, really.
With that, so. Pretty odd, frightening character, but if you look up his movie on YouTube, it's like, Jesus Christ, what was this guy starring in a movie?
Though, he looks like a rapist.
Yes, he does. He looks like Marc Maron.
He looks like Marc Maron. Yeah.
Yes, he's the Marc Maron type of rapist.
Oh, geez, you know, I didn't want to have sex with him. I'm such a mess. You know, I wouldn't have fucked that girl, but I'm such a mess. I can't control myself.
He looks like the guy who uses roofies and stuff. and talks a bunch of feminist claptrap at coffee houses to lure
You know, I'm such
park.
A feminist. You know, I watch Anita Sarkeesian's Feminist Frequency, and I just really believe in women's rights. Will you sleep with me?
Yeah. But at least I could say this is a solved. I don't know if it's really a Hollywood crime. It's technically a New York crime. It's definitely a Hollywood bastard. But apparently one of his tricks to start his sexual assault was he would have the woman hold his Oscar and go, "This could be yours."
Oh, what the fuck? Oh,
oh
God.
Boy. That is fucking odd.
Yeah.
I think that just – I don't think I'm going to get a boner for a month after hearing that.
Yeah. So this guy's a monster, but good riddance. He's dead. Saved New York taxpayers some money. It's just
yeah, exactly. Jesus.
No,
but yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty fucked up.
That's a crazy story. I've never heard that story.
It's not well known. I just remember hearing reports of his death, and then
for some reason
I was like, how come I don't? You know, I just remember seeing ads for "You Light Up My Life," the movie back in 1977, just constantly. Like on TV all the time, and it was just like, what happened to that film? Who made that? And then I looked it up and I'm like, oh, okay, this is why I never hear about it. It's like the guy's a piece of shit that was hated by everybody in Hollywood.
Yeah. Boy.
Well, I guess you can say he gave us casting couch porn. I don't know.
Oh no, that was around long before that.
Oh
long
yeah.
before that.
Gross.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's rumors about Stag Reel with Joan Crawford.
Oh God, that's probably the biggest crime in them all. Look at that fucking thing. Horrible looking woman. All right, Hannah, what's yours?
Okay, well, mine's going back, and the star, this movie, this crime, I should say, revolves around, is a star who's kind of known for scandal, but not like. I didn't hear about this scandal till I read about it. And I'm going to talk about the Errol Flynn rape trial.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, do y'all know about this one?
I know snippets of it, not much.
Just rumblings.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Errol Flynn, you know, one of the most charming, stars in Hollywood. You know him from, Adventures of Robin Hood. He became a star with the movie Captain Blood, and Flynn is from – actually, he's from Stewart's neck of the woods. Yeah. He's from Tasmania and mm-hmm. went to school in Australia and was kicked out because he was a fighting gentleman, you know.
And you know him as well from the Australian Crawl song Errol as well. So, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Errol Flynn was, you know – kind of well known as a poon hound. Mm-hmm. he could have sex with any woman he wanted, pretty much.
It was the accent.
It was, of course. People tell me, who's that guy you do a podcast with? I want to have sex with him, and I say, he's nobody. It's me.
I know that's a lie because you don't tell people you have a podcast. You're ashamed of it.
Well, not at school. Oh. I don't in certain forums, but those are people that you know, those are people who shouldn't be listening to our podcast because it's inappropriate. Anyway,
yeah.
But so Errol Flynn was you know, he was at his house and a police officer came to inform him that he was being charged with statutory rape. Okay, and that, you know, if you have sex with somebody under the age of 18 in California, this was in 1942, you would get thrown in the can for 5 years. So what happened was, I sound like a L.A. Mexican.
Yeah, would you like a bottle of Coca-Cola?
Yeah. So there was a girl named Betty Hansen. And cops had arrested her for vagrancy. And she had on her person the phone numbers for Errol Flynn and Bruce Cabot, who was in King Kong.
Right.
And she claimed that she had a tennis match with Bruce and Errol and then had a swim and sex party with them. And I don't know if that means sex with both of them, like Chinese finger cuffs or what. But she said that she had sex with Flynn and he was wearing his socks while they made love.
That's, you know, fucked.
Isn't that weird? But so Flynn said he denied it. He said he had seen her at a party and that's it. He had never had sex with her. And so he was booked, released on bail. And then when he got home, his phone rang. And he picked up the phone and it said, "Tell Jack I want $10,000." And that Jack is Jack Warner. And this was an extortionist saying, you know, "I want $10,000 from the studio." And the DA, the district attorney's office, was they didn't really have a great case. However, they just wanted to push it. And Flynn had a film coming out, Gentleman Jim, which was about the boxer James Corbett, and a Raoul Walsh film. Mm-hmm. And so this trial went on, and they dragged in another girl named Peggy Satterley, and rather top-heavy woman. She said that Errol had raped her on his yacht, the Sirica, in 1941. So this was a year earlier.
Let's just preface for a second. We don't find the rape funny at all. We're not laughing at that. Well, okay.
Yep.
But far from it.
But when you say somebody raped you on your yacht,
yeah, it's a location that's amusing. It's not the act.
Is it rape? I don't know. Is it rape or is it regret? I don't know.
It sounds like regret sex.
So, but and this was in 1941, so it was a year earlier, right. And so you know, Robin Hood charged with rape. You know, this was a headline. However, the two girls, Betty and Peggy, told completely different stories on facts, and Errol told different stories, and it was pretty clear that there was no case there, and the jury found in favor of Flynn, and he was it seemed like you know, everything was going to go okay, but for some reason, the DA's office overrode the jury's decision and continued to prosecute him. So the Hollywood hired a very powerful lawyer. And this was where the term "in like Flynn" came from, apparently.
Yeah,
I'm not exactly sure what it has to do with the trial, but it became a GI code word in the war, and which Flynn thought was hilarious. He loved it. So... So Flynn, the girl Peggy said what that happened on the ship, and you know, the lawyer asked her why she waited a whole year to discover that she'd been raped, and she said apparently one of the things that cracked up the court was she said that Flynn told her the moon would look more beautiful through a porthole because. She said she had sex with him. He had sex with her in front of every porthole. The moon would look more beautiful through the porthole. The case still was flimsy, and the girl. It seemed like the Betty girl had sex with Flynn, but it was consensual and not rape. It wasn't even statutory or something, but it. You know, what was interesting about this case, according to what's been written about it, is that such accusations against an actor, like there was something similar that happened to Fatty Arbuckle, and it ruined his career. Yeah. Fatty Arbuckle's career was destroyed by the rape murder accusations against him. With this, Flynn's movie Gentleman Jim came out and it was a hit. Critics liked it. It made money. And people didn't seem to care about this case against Flynn. And, you know, it wasn't a great case. against him. Like, it was kind of like probably Flynn had sex with some women who weren't his wife, and the cops used it. And here's where it got interesting, was that this was not like the thing was, is the studios and the LA politicians were in bed with each other, in that the studios gave money to LA politicians, and in return, if you know, their stars got in any trouble, if there was anything, you know, charges would be dropped. You know, they would, the cops would do damage control. However, this was 1942, so we were coming out of the Depression. Hollywood was making more money, and the new bosses of LA were thinking, you know, Hollywood's holding out on us. They have more money they can give us. Let's try to shake them down. And they used one of their biggest stars, Flynn, to try to, you know, put the squeeze on Hollywood. Jack Warner could have paid 10 grand and made it all go away. However, they decided to fight it in court. So it was not this sort of it was really more of a shakedown on corrupt Los Angeles politicians trying to squeeze money out of Hollywood based on their corrupt relationship. And Flynn was sort of the sacrificial lamb, if you will.
Right.
Well, also, he was probably one of the – maybe the biggest box office star at Warner Brothers.
Yeah, he was the biggest star, one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. So,
and I think they knew the rape charges would probably be laughed at by the general public, because they're like, is he super – you know, the ideas of rape back then, it would be like, oh, he's super handsome. Why would he have to rape? You know, it's just like –
exactly.
Just
like, I mean,
woman.
That's one
and
thing.
And that's how
that,
the public took it.
And so they, you know, you could see it as a change in attitudes on morality, but I doubt it. Like, it was more like people were like looking at Errol, they just did the math. You know?
Yeah. They were like, why would he have to do that? And, you know, the ideas and, you know, and, what woman would want him. You know, that idea would be out there in the public and they wouldn't care.
Exactly. And, but it was just, I just thought it was funny that it was this sort of, It's this rape case, but really it's about the relationship between Hollywood and the politicians, and about Hollywood's control over its stars. Like,
and
saying,
Jack Warner was brilliant, I think, to say, you know what, Flynn will get out.
He did the math. You know, he said,
and he's like, if I pay this extortion, I'm paying this every week. You know, for a different actor.
Exactly.
So,
and you said even they got this lawyer. What was his name? Geisler, and he made sure that 9 out of the 12 people on the jury were women.
Because Errol's going to get up there and flash the smile to Robin Hood.
Exactly! With that
a
smile, that mustache.
And the Captain Blood twitch of the eye, you know?
Yeah.
So, the story about Flynn, I got it from a book, which is basically the Bible of classic Hollywood illicit scandals and just overall creepiness.
I think I know which book you're going to mention. Yeah, okay.
I bet you do.
Yeah.
It's by one of – I know Stuart and I's favorite people, Kenneth Anger.
Yeah.
And it's the book Hollywood Babylon.
Yeah.
And if you like movies, I think Hollywood Babylon is an essential – book that you need to have in your library, and Hollywood Babylon 2 as well. Kenneth Anger just fills it up with all the sleaze and scum of old Hollywood, and it's a beautiful entry into your thing. But it's from a chapter called In Like Flynn, and there's some good ones. Like, I was reading it today, just looking to see what would be a good one to drudge out.
Yeah.
For this episode, but if you want great scummy film history, Hollywood Babylon, I think it needs to be on everybody's bookshelf.
And Kenneth Anger, being a child actor at the time as well, was privy to a lot of shit going on.
Yeah, his family was in the industry, and you know, of course, he went on to make some of the legendary avant-garde films.
And we never ever did that Kenneth Anger show we spoke about when we first started.
When we first started doing this show, we never did it.
We just fucking...
John, Stu and I have been... since the show began, have been talking about doing a Kenneth Anger show. And yeah. It just hasn't happened.
No, hasn't happened.
Oh, odd. Yeah, I read Hollywood Babylon and Hollywood Babylon 2, and I remember when they were big hits in paperback when they came out. Like they sold to everybody. They didn't just sell to like movie buffs, but women who like to read about the stars and stuff. That used to be a huge reading subgenre before the National Enquirer got all political.
I think these days they're on film buff shelves.
Yeah,
but because I mean, I found out about this book from my college film teacher, you know, like he was the one who brought it to class one day, and I went, I have to own this, and I went and found a copy.
You didn't find out from the Misfits?
No, I didn't actually.
Yeah, well, that part.
I got into the Misfits after I found after I owned a copy of this book.
Did you get into the Misfits around the American Psycho period?
No, you know,
with that album cover that you told me about.
Here's the thing about the Misfits. I discovered them in high school because of Metallica.
Yeah.
A lot of people. But I didn't really delve into them until I was in college. So, but I did have some of their stuff when I was in high school because I knew of them because, you know, Metallica covered them and preached the Misfits gospel. So
I actually knew of Sam Hain first before I knew of the Misfits.
You know what? Which I discovered Sam Hain by accident. I was in Scotland, and I saw a Sam Hain CD. I think it was in Morgan's apartment.
Which one was it? Initium or November?
No, it was a November Coming Fire.
Right.
And I went, what is this? Because I saw the Danzig skull on the cover.
Yeah.
And Morgan went, oh, you know, he showed it to me, and I was like, oh my gosh, because this was when I was like first discovering the Misfits and loving them. And I had gotten a couple of Danzig albums, and so I was like, there's this whole other band I didn't know about, you know.
Oh, a lot of people don't know about Sam Hain.
Was out of print at that point in the U.S. like you couldn't find, you had to go like go through used bookstores to
I remember seeing
you had to hunt down the Caroline CDs.
You really did. Yeah, I remember
and
seeing
I found all of them eventually, but you know,
yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing fucking Sam Hain stuff on the shelf when it was out. I'm like, what is this? It's like, because you, like, they're imports, so those things were not cheap. Even back in 85, 84, when they were out. So,
have
Jesus
any of y'all
Christ.
Heard the new Danzig covers album, Skeletons?
I've heard of it. It came out last week or something, was it?
Yeah, it came out last
week. So I saw the tracks, and I'm like, it doesn't grab me, you know? It's not like, I haven't heard it, so I can't really pass a statement what I thought of it, but I mean, just look at the tracks he's covering, like, it just, nah. I mean, when he did Trouble on the Thrall Demon Sweat one, that could be, I mean, I thought to myself, that could be interesting because obviously the Elvis, you know, connection with
Danzig. Yeah, it's from King Creole.
Sure. So I'm like, oh, well, that could be interesting. And I heard it, I thought it was great. I really liked it a lot. But looking at the track listing, this was it Skeletons, right? It's called?
Skeletons.
Yeah, yes. I'm just like it's just none of it's grabbed me. I'm just no thanks. I mean, I'll give it a listen when I can find it somewhere. But yeah, I'm not in a hurry. Let's say that much. He still burnt me after Black Aria. I've got that. I'm like, this is just pathetic. What
yeah,
is
Black
this
Aria
crap?
Is a jerking off. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, and it's not even very good.
But I thought his last album, Death Red Sabbath, was really good.
That was fun.
The other one was all right. I think the last one I really liked of his was before that was the one that had Five Finger Crawl on it. Was it Danzig 6? 666 Satan's Curse? Or Satan's Child, what it's called?
Yeah. That might have been 777. Let me see. Hold on. I have all of his albums, so I'm going to look.
The only one I really don't like is 5. I think Black Acidella, I think it's ridiculous. It's just fucking horrible. I mean, I own it because I picked up
666 Satan's Child.
Yeah, I think I like that one quite a bit.
It has 13, which is a great song. Johnny Cash did it.
Of course, yeah. Written by Danzig. That's right. I think I actually like the Danzig version better than the Johnny Cash one. Of 13,
it was
yeah.
used in The Hangover.
Oh, I've seen it. You won't catch you watching those fucking movies ever.
Dude, I knew I was going to like The Hangover when the opening credits kick in. And it shows Las Vegas with, like, time-lapse photography, and it's playing Danzig's 13. I was like, oh, my God.
So did you watch it in the movies, the theater?
I saw it in the theater. I saw it
in
the theater.
Did people rush up to you and say, hey, Zach, I really enjoyed your film? Because you had the full beard rocking by then, wouldn't you? Or not?
I had a goatee.
Oh, just saying. Oh, okay.
Right now I have a full beard.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But the thing with Skeletons is I really like Danzig's singing on it. You've heard it? Yeah, I've heard it, and I really like his singing on it. Like, his singing on Rough Boy and
Fine
Body and stuff. It was really good. Like, I was like, oh, he's kind of not some singing I expect from him.
See, that's ZZ Top's Rough Boy, right?
Yes, it is.
I didn't even like that one ZZ Top did it. I just thought, this is just dumb.
And you know what? I don't like ZZ Top's version of it either.
Yeah.
But I like that version.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any of the 80s production or any of that, you know?
That Afterburner album's not good.
Not. It's a product of its time.
Yeah, it really is.
It's their first truly bad album.
Yeah, it's a carbon. It's basically...
His version of it, I really liked it, you know? I was like, oh, this is a good, the way he sings it, he has some real emotion in it that I really liked.
Man, you listen to Billy Gibbons say, he sounds like he's had too much of his own hot sauce. His voice is gone.
He just put out a new solo record, Correctamundo or something, which sounds a little too Billy Gibbons-ish with that title. I don't know.
The songs are all about fast cars, Texas, and barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he said he's ever... It's all it means to the most of him in life is fast cars, barbecue, and Texas. That's all he wants. And women.
But Skeletons is getting beaten in the press, but there's some of the covers on it I really like. I think some of them are terrible, but some of them are really good.
Well, there you go.
The press never liked them.
They have always, you know, beaten him up. Like, you know, anytime Danzig comes up, they bring up him getting punched out by the Northside Kings.
Oh, that's one of the best videos out there.
They bring up French onion soup. You know, they bring up
the Shakira mix, the Shakira mashup,
which is pretty amazing.
It is. It's very well done.
Even before that, they hated him. They were always like, oh, he's the meanest man from New Jersey with his comic book collection. They always hated him. I remember reading negative reviews of him for years.
I actually found a copy of that Erotica. Is it Erotica or Satanica? That was the comic he did?
Satanica. Was, yeah.
Right, yeah. I've actually got one of those issues.
But the Devil's Angels and Satan Sadists themes, they sound like Misfit songs. Like his NIB cover's really bad, I think. But a lot of the covers are really good. Like, I think his version of Rough Boy, you know, grounds the ZZ Top one into the dust. With A Girl Like You's fun. Find Somebody's Great. Crying in the Rain. I'm not that well versed in the Everly Brothers, so I can't really compare.
I know it. It's classic, really.
But Danzig does a good. I think he does a good job crooning it, and he does Elvis's Let Yourself Go. Aerosmith's Lord of the Thighs.
Quite ironic that Elvis and Danzig both let themselves go, that they should both have that song.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. Let Yourself Go. Anyway, but let's get back on topic.
All right. Yeah, enough plugging Danzig's new album.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know how I got there, but anyway.
Yeah, this show, God, when is there ever a straight track on this show?
It should be called the Midnight Tangent Cowboys.
It really should, yeah.
We're looking at that as a name change, probably.
Yeah, yeah, really. We should start a new format called Tangent Cast.
I'm actually thinking about, this is just thinking out loud, but I've been thinking about actually doing a Mr. Aeroshelf podcast.
Oh, my God.
Like,
is that a joke? Are you for real?
No, I'm for real because, Tom and Joachim have really, they did their Masters of Cinema cast, and they've cultivated a great relationship with Masters of Cinema.
So you just want free shit, basically.
They put out a show a month. You know, they get really cool guests like myself, and they got picked up by a larger podcast network, and I was like, that might be a fun thing to do.
So
one show a month, you know.
Yeah, John, we got a guy who's now conforming to the system. Fuck, man.
Hey,
yeah.
If I want to do it on the side, whatever.
No, I'm just kidding.
All out of one line joke I made.
Does John get a kickback for any sort of future shit you get in the future? Like, you know, if you get multiple pressings of some ridiculous fucking movie from 1944.
I watched The Last Arrow Shelf. The movie I watched off the Arrow Shelf this weekend was Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key.
Oh, I saw that years ago.
By Sergio Martino. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a waste of fucking an inch and a half on the shelf, I tell you.
Oh, I liked it quite a bit.
Of course you do. Really. Although, having said that, there's a 3-for-20 deal going in the Amazon UK at the moment. And I clicked on a few titles and holy shit, I think nearly all of them were Arrow titles. I'm like, no, I can't do it, really. So, I can't go down the Arrow road. But, damn good titles. I may still budge and get them yet. Because one of them was Maniac Cop, the Arrow version. I really want that. You got that one?
I do not. I have a few of the UK ones, like the Beyond and the Battle Royale one, of course. You're the reason I have that. But I've been getting a lot of their US ones because they recently, this past year, they started distributing in the US. So I've been buying a lot of those.
That's not for a region purpose, because I know you've got a region free player. Is it strictly price?
In fact, their UK ones play on my region one player.
Okay.
So it's not that. It's just I can go to the store and buy one, you know? Like, it's the store near me carries them. Like, you know, I went and I got their Black Cat box set, which had Your Vice and Fulci's Black Cat.
Right. The one I was actually going to get was a Hammer title. It was Hands of the Ripper, which I really like that one. It's finally hit Blu-ray. And it's supposed to be a spanking looking Blu-ray as well, but it's part of the 3-for-20 deal, so I'm like, I got to get that and just finally retire my old crappy full-screen Laserdisc I've had since 1993, whatever it is. So, yeah, there was that, Maniac Cop, and there was something else in there. Might have been People Under the Stairs, the Arrow one. I can't remember. Anyway, yeah.
Scream Factory put that out in Region 1.
Yeah. Not Scream Factory, but Shout Factory now finally putting out the Gong Show movie on Blu-ray. Thank God.
Boy.
Yeah, because I've got it on full screen DVD, which was not released. It was actually off cable. It played one night. I'm like, shit. I can't remember the last time it's ever played on TV at all. So I recorded it. And it's not a great movie at all, but it's about the best we got with the Gong Show out there to buy, because none of the episodes have ever been released from my memory. John, you might want to correct me if they have been released in some way or manner.
I may have gotten a manufacturing on demand release at one point. I thought, but maybe not.
But it's possible, because I've just never. I don't think it even got a VHS release, the Gong Show, because I don't.
It seems like it did, but
you reckon?
Would have been very brief in the early 80s if it did. I know it was a very collectible bootleg item on VHS in like the 90s. Like, video pirates could sell it at, you know, horror conventions and stuff.
Because it's a universal title, so you'd have to think it may have got, if anything, at least a VHS release. I know it did not get a DVD release anywhere in the world, because I've been looking.
Right.
Probably
no perceived market, really, because Gong Show's kind of forgotten in America. It was really big for like 2 or 3 years in the 70s, and then it's been kind of forgotten.
God, that show is just so fucking out of control.
George Clooney's Confessions of a Dangerous Mind has kept it alive in our consciousness, right?
Which was not a hit.
No,
it was not.
Yeah.
I knew John would point that out when I said that.
Not a hit.
Hunter, have you seen any of the Gong Show clips, not the movie, but the actual clips of the show.
No, I've only seen Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. I know what it is.
Man, John would have definitely seen it. I guarantee you that back in its day.
Yeah.
Holy shit. It was like a... the most famous one is... because it was a talent show, right?
Yeah.
And basically, there'd be like three judges. Who was it usually? Was it...
Would be there. JP Morgan. David Letterman before he was a talk show host.
Right.
A lot of like kind of minor comedians of the day and stuff.
Yeah, the Unknown Comic was popular on there. Murray Langston.
The Unknown Comic was always there. A regular at one point.
Yeah, yeah. Gene the Dancing Machine, who was a black guy with two wooden legs.
It was like a syndicated thing in the U.S. and like every day it was on every day. It was a weekday.
I'll tell you what it was. Actually, if I think about it, it was like a pre-Howard Stern Whack Pack is what it was.
Yeah.
Similar to. And Chuck Barris was the host. And the most famous one that got – I don't even know, did it air at all? Was the – it was two teenage girls in shorts and T-shirt. They just came out, sat on the floor, and just grabbed an icy pole and just started sucking on the icy poles.
I think it aired.
Did it? Okay.
Right, the best one you can watch on YouTube, if it's still up, is you can see the Mystic Knights of Oingo Boingo win it by doing a performance, and it's pretty
amazing.
Like, it's actually really cool. It's back when
Is this Forbidden Zone era Oingo, Forbidden
this
Knights
is before, of Oingo Boingo? This is years Mystic before Knights? Forbidden Zone. Years before Forbidden Zone.
This is like was when Richard Elfman was fronting the band.
Yeah, Richard Elfman's actually leading the band, and they have like a giant dragon costume, and it's nuts. It's like really crazy.
You got to check that show out, Hunter. Gong Show. Just grab the snippets what you can. You'll just sit there and go, no way they got away with that in the '70s because it's fucking insane.
What's really interesting is they tried to spin it off into a network version called the Chuck Barris Rah Rah Show, and I think that only ran for like maybe a month or two because it like flopped on the network. But it did. It always did great in syndication, at least for like 5 years or 4 or 5 years it was on.
Yeah. Yeah, because I've been wanting to do the Gong Show movie on this show for the longest time, but now the Blu-ray release coming out in 3 or 4 months, or it is, I really want to request that title to put on here, because I think it'd be interesting to get a take on just, I mean, because the show, yeah, it's dated, but it's still shocking, some of the things you see on that on those clips from that time period. It's still shocking to see some of it. You think, how the fuck did they get away with that?
No, now they could get away with that crap all the time. It's like it's almost not.
Oh, it's like a prerequisite these days, you know?
I know. It's very easy to get away with that stuff now.
Yeah. But, Gong Show movie, definitely it's one I'll be putting my hand up for a request on this show to be done. Because
The one you couldn't do today is CPO Sharky. Because really? I started watching that. Yeah.
I've never heard of it.
It's a sitcom designed for Don Rickles. So he's basically a... commander for the Navy, and he's training. He's got his squad that he's training, and of course it's Don Rickles. So one of the guys is a you have a black recruit, you have a Polish recruit, you have a Puerto Rican recruit, you have every stereotype, you have a dumb Southerner, you have everything designed for Don Rickles to do his act on the sitcom.
Holy shit!
And make like you know. Polish jokes, black jokes, Southern jokes, Puerto Rican jokes, Mexican jokes, anything.
Rickles is L.O. Dummy. It's one of the best comedy albums ever.
It is. But CPO Sharky was totally designed for him. It's just like it's just a way for him to insult them for like a half hour.
Is that on the box set you bought? Was it?
Yeah, it is. I'd never seen it. I'd always heard about it because it was one of the only sitcoms I ever heard about my dad enjoying. Like, he'd always mention CPO Sharky. So I think men who did not watch sitcoms back then, they would watch CPO Sharky for Don Rickles. Because he was, like, he was everybody's hero back then.
I can totally think of this podcast an extension of guys like Don Rickles and all that. Because we just make every sort of fucking joke. And then people just go, oh, we're racist pigs. And, no, we're just embodying the whole comedy culture that was back in that time. That's all.
Yeah, I grew up on that comedy culture.
Oh, me too. Totally, yeah.
I was never into this, like, politically correct, weird, you know.
Oh, God.
We'll just attack white rednecks you know, is responsible for everything type humor.
I nearly smashed my fucking car radio the other day with an axe because I heard a woman come on the radio, and this is completely irrelevant. Well, it's relevant, but it's completely irrelevant to the show. She came on the radio, and being December, you know, everyone says, oh, Merry Christmas. She gets on, she goes, oh, hi, guys. She's talking to this guy, Bruce and Phil, who do a show here. I don't want to seem politically incorrect, but Merry Christmas to you. I thought, what the fuck are you talking about? Where the fuck's the political incorrect? This is saying Merry Christmas.
Yeah, it's now.
Oh, no, I just switched it off. I said, you stupid bitch. I turned it off. I was like, all right. Ridiculous. I don't want to be politically incorrect to the fucking Muslims?
Pfft. Right.
Go fuck a pig. Seriously. I'm just dropped dead. He can't blows, take it.
They're politically correct by blowing shit up, so.
Yeah. Yeah, really? Yeah. Okay. So speaking of scandals and deaths and shit.
Let's get back on topic.
Yeah. Don't upset the Muzzies, you know.
No, yeah.
Don't want to do that.
You don't want any jihad and chill up in here.
You don't want a fatwa on our heads.
And then Cat Stevens going on national television saying, "Well, if the Ayatollah said it, then it we got to do it."
You know? There's only one Ayatollah we follow. There's only one Ayatollah we follow on this show, isn't it? And you know who it is. Come on,
rock and roll.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go.
Real one.
We only entered to cajole Nelson, or his name is, I've forgotten. The one guy who wouldn't take my phone calls here in Melbourne, so fuck him. But anyway, mine is not as in-depth as you guys' one is, because I came a little bit ill-prepared, so I apologize in advance, folks. But mine is the something I remember that happened when I was about 21, when I was working in town in the CBD and out in the lunch break, and I see this headline. It says, actor killed on film set. I'm like, oh, what is this? And I looked at it, and it was the death of Brandon Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and this is where I think John, Matt, if any one of us could probably elaborate a bit on this. Now, there was talk about the triads that gotten to him, and the Lee curse, and all that sort of shit, and... what do you know about this, John? Because I actually brought it up because I wanted to find out a bit more, because it's very vague. What's out there, information-wise, is very vague, very jaded.
What happened was they were filming The Crow, and of course he was killed by... The official story was it was a blank cartridge that somehow... there was some...
Had like an object in the barrel or something?
Like they said like the tip of a bullet was like trapped by the blank. I read this book written by a British journalist who investigated it, and she said that what happened was the prop crew was target shooting with those guns the night before. They went target shooting the day before. When on the set, what actually hit Brandon Lee was a real bullet that was left in there because they did not double check the weapons. They have a prop master on the set double checking everything. Later, I talked to a stuntman who knows everybody in the stunt industry and everything, and he said problem was on that set, they were working everybody like 12-hour shoots or whatever, and he says there's no union there. He said the stuntman who should have been double-checking the weapon was on another set while they were filming second unit stuff.
Right.
And ran as soon as they heard about Lee collapsing. He was like Bruce Lee, Brandon Lee's best friend, Jeff Amata, who I've mentioned on the show before, yeah. Also friends with Ali Young. And it was basically non-union shoot. The director, Alex Proyas, foolishly allowed the actor, Michael Massey, to aim a gun at Brandon Lee. The truth is about guns, you never aim them at another actor on a set.
That's like gun safety 101.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's the first thing you learn when you're a kid and you have toy guns. Your dad, if he's gun knowledgeable, will say, don't ever aim that at another person. You know, because you don't want that habit. And like,
hold a gun, you aim it up in the ceiling. You know, you
right?
Aim it up.
And so he allowed the actor to basically shoot. And you're not even supposed to shoot a blank at an actor. Like that's still dangerous.
Yeah,
it does fire something. But
I mean, there's a joke about that in the movie In Bruges. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Where like the guy has blanks in his gun. And right. like the, Colin Farrell takes the gun from this drug dealer who's threatening him, and then they're like, "Oh, there's just blanks in the gun." And he's like, "What you gonna do? What you gonna do now, you poof?" And he goes, "I'll tell you what, you poof." And like Colin Farrell fires the blank into his eyes and blights
yeah.
him.
Well, you've only got to remember this might be before your time, Hunter. There was a soap actor called John Eric Hexham.
Oh, I don't know about this.
Okay. He was fooling around with a stage gun on the set, or his own property. I think it was on the set, and it had blanks loaded in it only. No real bullets. Blanks only. Put it to his temple, it still killed him.
God damn. Yeah. I mean, it still fires out, like, it still fires something out. It's not like...
Right, you don't want it close to
you. Like, it's not like shooting, it's not like playing laser tag.
Yeah, no, it's not.
I mean, not like, at all.
People are such retards when it comes to guns. It cracks right. me up.
Because people seem to think, I mean, I'm not knowledgeable in guns, sorry, John, I'm not knowledgeable in guns, I mean, at all, but even I fucking know, a blank doesn't mean there's literally nothing in the barrel. There's still something there.
It's got goddamn gunpowder in it.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes. It shoots like a wax, sort of a wax wax paraffin or something. It just shoots it out like a wax wad of paper. But I mean, it's coming out with the force of gunpowder and with the gun's caliber, so you really have to think about that. With that velocity, it's still dangerous. And you just, you know, the thing is, you don't allow an actor to aim a gun at another actor and fire. It's crazy. And
it's ridiculous.
You had an inexperienced director, you had a non-union shoot, you had, it was in North Carolina where the laws didn't apply that apply in Hollywood.
Like, for a industry that shits on big business as much as film does, they are some of the worst when it comes to cutting costs and cutting corners in at the expense of safety. Like I've seen the way like these people operate, and it's repulsive. You know, they're fucking scumbags, and yet they're the most they're the ones pretending to be all like liberal and for all these things.
I don't even know why they put blanks in the gun to begin with. I mean, what's the point? You can add all that shit in ADR later with the fucking sound effects.
It's true, and I think they want that smoke. Of course, now you can just do it with CGI.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which I think is what Robert Rodriguez does. So.
Robert Rodriguez uses a spark gun. I'm not sure how that works, but I know
he does everything in editing, but it's probably the way the Japanese do it. If you watch those Japanese films from the 60s and 70s, guns are completely illegal in Japan, so even studios can't use them as props. So they have to create these imitation guns with like that are electronically triggered, where they create an orange flash. And but they have no gunpowder with them or whatever, so they look weird on film because they have these crazy orange flashes. Like if you watch a Sonny Chiba movie, they're shooting a gun, it's like this wacky orange flash. And there's a Yakuza film where Ken Takakura just kills like 50 other Yakuzas with a Tommy gun, and it's emitting that orange flash. The funny thing about a Tommy gun is, if you know, they have that drum clip that you always see in the old gangster movies,
mm-hmm.
under the barrel. Well, this had no drum clip, so basically he's killing everybody with a Tommy gun with no clip. So if you know anything about guns, it's pretty ridiculous. But nowadays I don't know any reason why they didn't even have to use real weapons. And I was told by somebody who was on the set of that David Mamet show, The Unit, he said that when they carry guns around, they're rubber props. And when they fire them, there's a different one used for the firing. But with the ones that are carried around by the actors are actually just kind of rubber, you know, look-alike props.
Makes sense. Makes total sense, yeah.
But I know the Brandon Lee incident probably scared everybody in the industry just to get smart about that shit. But, yeah, it's an unfortunate incident. He had signed, like, we talk about film contracts. He had signed multi-picture deals with different studios at the time.
Yeah. So I watched.
He was going to be the next big thing.
Yeah, because I watched
The
Crow.
Well, at least he didn't have to be in Crow, City of Angels, am I right?
No, it's bad. I watched The Crow at the start of the year, and I really enjoyed it. It still held up quite well. It was.
It's a good movie. I like it.
It is. It's. I didn't know how it was going to date after 20-odd years, so I popped on and popped in the theater room. Like, wow, I really enjoyed that. You know, that 100 minutes really flew by.
Fun flick.
Yeah, I watched Crow 2. I'm like, oh, God, this is horrible.
It's just dog shit. And
Salvation as well. It's just.
The Crow, City of Angels, the video game is even worse.
Really?
Oh, my God. Was it the angry video game nerd just did a video about it, and it's so funny. I forgot what a piece of crap that game was. Just is even worse than the movie.
Worse than
at least the movie had Iggy Pop. You know.
Well, yeah, that was about it. But I mean, all the rest of it was just garbage.
But Pro Salvation was bad. Crow Wicked Prayer was even worse.
Was that the TV series? Was it the TV series? No,
Wicked Prayer was the one with Edward Furlong and David Boreanaz.
Oh, that's the one I've got in my Netflix queue. I'm like, oh,
it has Dennis Hopper.
Of course it does. Yeah.
Dennis Hopper talks like street slang. It's hilarious.
That that artist who created The Crow, James LeBar, he's told a friend of mine. He says, "I wish I had never created The Crow because Brandon Lee would be alive."
I've heard that he has a lot of guilt over.
I met him. He's a really nice guy.
He comes to the conventions in Dallas.
He's from Dallas, isn't he?
He's always there. He's always at the conventions there.
That's the running joke that we said back on the collector sector. Cole would mention convention. He goes, and of course James O'Barr's going to be there. I'm like, okay.
He doesn't want to do any comic books. It's just easier, I think, to just do commissions and sell drawings at the conventions.
Sure.
He's basically coasted on that Crow reputation his entire career. He hasn't really done anything else.
Mm.
And he collects royalties for every time they do a Crow spinoff comic.
I feel like, if I ever get to a convention, Dallas just got me saying, "You're the guy who had Brandon Lee killed." Oh, okay, it's you. But no, he's riddled with guilt about it.
He liked Brandon. Like, they palled around. And
yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah, so. If he's still guilty about it, I was like, "Oh, you're the guy who had Brandon Lee murdered. You're responsible for his death." Oh, okay.
The real responsible person is the Australian, Alex Proyas.
Alex Proyas, yeah. Yeah.
You should say, "What did Brandon ever do to you?"
Can you sign my copy of the Crow Blu-ray, please, while you're at it?
By the way, I'm just kidding. Sign my copy of the Crow Blu-ray. Thank you.
Thanks. yeah. Boy, that Brandon Lee had a lot of talent. He could have gone far if it wasn't for you. But thanks anyway. Have a good day. Just shake your head going, "Man, that Brandon Lee, what a waste, eh?"
And that was the movie that was supposed to get him out of the whole, martial arts action movie.
What, the classics like Laser Mission?
Rapid Fire and Shodown in Little Tokyo.
Oh god, that's a fave of me.
Shodown in Little Tokyo was so bad it was barely released.
It's fucking horrible.
It was a regional dump, terrible movie. And then Rapid Fire was a minor hit.
I liked it. I saw Rapid Fire in the theater. I'm sure I saw it in the theater.
I saw it in the theater opening.
Yeah. No, not about opening day, but I definitely caught it in the theater. Maybe even driving. I think I can't remember.
And it was a minor hit. But he was on to bigger and better things, and then death. In fact, the script for what became Die Hard with a Vengeance was originally written as a Rapid Fire sequel.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
It could have been interesting.
It was remade into a Die Hard script.
Okay. Into a bad Die Hard script, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, it's a pretty awful film.
No, I don't like it at all.
By the way, for our listener who wanted us to talk about the worst buddy film, Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Die Hard with a Vengeance is pretty bad.
Either
that or Showdown in Little Tokyo, and there you go.
What about Lethal Weapon 3? Lethal Weapon 3 is pretty fucking bad.
Lethal Weapon 3 is pretty awful. I mean, there's quite a few, but pretty much any sequel or just unreleasable film like Showdown in Little Tokyo.
You know what? Even Lethal Weapon 4 was a pile of shit.
It sucked. It's terrible.
You know, it's just.
Let's rope Chris Rock in because he's a hot comedian. So let's put him in the movie for no reason at all.
Another 48 hours as well.
Oh God, that was terrible.
That was pretty fucking bad. I'm not into that. I'm all over that that buddy cop, buddy friend crap.
It's already Freebie and the Bean did it all.
It is. It really is. Like
really
you said,
no reason
yeah.
to watch another one. There's no reason for any other one to exist.
And you know what? Maybe you got
Rush perfected the genre.
Yeah, you go up to a ton of people and say, "Do you know Die Hard with Vengeance? You know Lethal Weapon 2? Do you know this? Do you know Freebie and the Bean? What? Never heard of it. The one film that did it right is the one film nobody fucking knows."
Well, and there's never been a decent release of it. You have to get it from Warner Archive, you know?
Yeah, which is a damn shame, really. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, and it wasn't shown on cable much in the '80s. Like yeah. it was turned and like
for like because that's reason, where that's where movies had a life was cable.
Yeah, and that didn't play very much. You had to rent the videotape.
If it had played more, I think it would be. You know?
Oh yeah, but it's like, and I almost feel like Warner Brothers suppressed it because of Lethal Weapon. They want to be accused of ripping it off.
You reckon?
Goddamn Shane Black, you, scumbag.
You wonder about those things. It's like, why is that movie out of circulation suddenly? Like, there was a Charlton Heston movie where he looked just like what Harrison Ford looked like in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And he's got the leather,
jacket,
and hat. And I think he even had a whip. And that movie, it was really hard to see for a long time and just kind of slowly snuck out on video.
But you think with Freebie and the Bean, if they had to put it out and if they were worried about Lethal Weapon, they could have said before, on the tagline down the bottom, even like superimposed, before Lethal Weapon, there was Freebie and the Bean. Just to.
Yeah, they. Well.
They wouldn't do that.
Not to take the glory away from it or something, but.
They didn't want Mel Gibson screaming at them, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. But studios are weird like that. They think very strangely. Like, they have these bizarre strategies.
I think if anything,
they got rid of the lawyers that protected, ever since the studio system fell.
I think, if anything, that reason why that film was sort of held or suppressed or whatever from the, getting multiple home video releases, probably from Richard Rush, probably the studio said, this guy's a fucking pain in the ass to deal with.
Could be a middle finger at him, but yeah. Or just James Caan had fallen out of favor or whatever. But it's like, I just noticed it never really played on television or cable TV past like 1982.
Well, you look at his other film, The Stuntman from 1980. How easy is that to get? It's not. I mean, you can probably get it now, but
it got a pretty big re-release here. Like, I remember it was pretty easy to find here for a while.
Yeah, but it wasn't accessible everywhere to get. I mean, over here, I know. God.
Because I remember, there was a period where I could go and just grab it at the store.
Okay, yeah. Look, so it probably was easier to get, but not easy to get still.
Right, no, there was a period where I remember they put out like a limited edition DVD of it for a while, and that was all you could get. Then they put out like a Blu-ray.
Well, Anchor Bay put it out about 10 years ago, because that's where I bought it. And I remember it was on a 20th Century Fox videotape in the 80s. It was always a big cult movie, The Stuntman. Mm-hmm. But it was like, it was only going to appeal to a cult audience. They weren't going to try to push it as a big retro hit.
And it's a cult movie. Like, it's not like a mainstream. It doesn't have that kind of appeal.
They should have put it down the bottom there to sell more copies from the director of Color of Night.
Yeah, of course.
See what,
of course. Everybody loves that film, right?
Oh, God.
I actually saw that opening day in Memphis.
Yeah. What theaters?
One of those theaters that was, I think, right off the highway that was, like, when you're coming into Memphis, and it's, like, four or five screens. But they would always get movies like Color of Night and Serial Mom, and it wasn't one of the nicer Germantown theaters. But, I went to see it, like, opening day because I liked Richard Rush's stuff because of Freebie and the Bean and the Stuntman. You know, yeah. I was into his stuff.
He's kind of like the Terrence Malick of cult films. Like,
yeah, you know? And I was really into his work, and then so I went to see that over today. I was like, oh god, what did I do?
It was bad. Like, I remember seeing the drive, and I think we mentioned on the theater, one of the theater experiences show or something we've done before in the past, where all I gave a fuck about was trying to bang that hot Sri Lankan girl I was with in the car. I'm like, this ain't happening. Fuck this movie, seriously. So, I mean, she was fucking hot. I mean, really hot. But unless she ain't having a bar of it, I'm like, oh, this film's fucked. It hasn't done me any favors, so I'm going on. Never spoke to her again. Never spoke to her again after that. I'm like, you frigid bitch, piss off. Yeah. So anyway, getting back to it, Brandon Lee was my one. That was one that, there's so many scandals out there. Has been, always will be.
And I'll say, like, you know, again, that Kenneth Anger book, Hollywood Babylon 2, you'll get your fill of Hollywood scandals from those.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I bet you will. Yeah.
And they're full of pictures, too. Like, you know, like, great pictures.
Like, I can't believe.
You want to see some Hollywood corpses? There you go. You know?
Yeah, that actually started the Black Dahlia cult. It was fascinating with that case.
Yeah. Anytime I hear, like, people who are obsessed with, sort of old Hollywood creepiness, like the Black Dahlia. They
like Rob Zombie. Yeah.
Rob Zombie, but
comedians like Dana Gould, you know, that's like their
bubble. Oh, Jesus. Okay. Speaking of scandals, what about the the cast of Different Strokes? I met with some pretty foul play over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of them was a subject of Postal 2, and now there's a mod you can get with where you fight only Milo Yiannopoulos.
You know what I'd love to do one day? One day.
John, I was like, I was waiting for John's reaction there.
Milo.
And it uses Milo's voice. You kill Milo, he's just like, oh, my hair.
That's awesome.
And what was it when Gavin was like, I don't think Milo plays video games. I'm going to find out. And he calls Milo, and Milo goes, what I play is Postal 2 with this mod. And Gavin looks at it. He goes, okay, he doesn't play video games or he's fucking with us.
Yeah, I think Gavin's probably right.
I think Milo's playing to a persona, personally.
Yeah, it's a persona. Yeah.
I have no idea who you're talking about. No idea.
Milo Yiannopoulos is a Gamergate guy who trolls liberals, and he's hilarious. I like him.
Huh.
But he's one of these tech guys who trolls liberals, but like, you know, there's not much evidence that he plays video games, but when he says he plays video games, what video games do you play? I play this game that's about me. Like, he has, it's like, but it feels like a cultivated persona where he's like this narcissistic guy, you know, that's like this thing, like he's gay, he's narcissistic, he's super conservative.
Okay, well.
It's pretty funny.
Oh, okay then, no worries. But yeah, so anyway, my one was Brendan Lee, so I just wanted to get some more info on it. But yeah, I just did trawl through 90 minutes of bizarre Hollywood deaths, like the today on YouTube, like the Rebecca Schaefer one. And
oh, yeah. I remember when those hit the news, too. I remember getting
Dorothy
a phone call
Stratton.
From Brendan Lee. Yeah, Dorothy Stratton. I remember that being in the news.
Yeah.
I'll say a couple that I considered doing that I didn't do. One was Thelma Todd, the ice cream blonde.
Oh, from the Marx Brothers films.
Yep.
Right.
She was murdered by many speculate Lucky Luciano.
Was she murdered? Was she the one found in the garage?
She was found
carbon
in the garage,
monoxide poisoning.
But there was like blood on her. Like it kind of believed that she was murdered. But in another one,
she's an attractive woman as well.
Yeah, she was. Yeah. She was very attractive. The other one I wanted to do was Lupe from the Tarzan movies.
Okay.
And I almost did that one because I'm related to Johnny Weissmuller. So I almost did that one.
Can I ask you how removed are you from Johnny Weissmuller?
He's a cousin on my dad's side.
Oh, really? Okay, so it's not that far removed.
It's not that far. It's not like insanely close, but it's not that far either.
We got Mr. Tarzan shelf now, huh? We got Mr. Azure, some Tarzan. Tarzan.
Hunter Weissmuller.
J.H. Weissmuller.
Cheetah. No.
Cheetah. No.
Yeah, really. Oh, cool.
I know. Now,
so you've been playing with your Vine lately, huh? Have you?
Oh, my Vine account, yes. No. No.
No, you're hanging Vine.
No, but I have been going to the gym every day, so.
Oh, you're still on that gym kick, are you?
Well, I fell off for a little bit because I was going in the morning.
Yeah, you're doing like insane 5 a.m. routines or something.
I was getting up at 5 to go to the gym. And
I'm going to bed at 5 when I finish work.
But dude, it got to where I was like falling asleep at work. Like after I was done with class, after I was done teaching, I would be falling asleep. And I just said, I can't do this anymore. And because I was just so low on energy, it was starting to flatline. And what I was, I always made the excuse. I went, well, I'm not going to go after work because that's when the gym's super crowded.
Yeah.
But I said, screw that. I'm going home. I'm going to eat a snack, go to, you know, just an energy snack, you know, go to the gym.
Yeah.
And I started doing that, and it has been 50 million times better.
Oh, look, I used to train at night, always about 6:30.
Yeah, and you know what? My routine now is I wake up, eat breakfast, drink coffee, go to work, come home, eat a snack, go to the gym, walk my dog, do whatever needs to be done, go to bed. And it is a much better routine.
You just need to be eating about 5 times a day, that's all. Just small
It's been a lot. It's been a lot better. Like, I'll eat like some protein after I get home. But I'll get home from workout, eat something, take my dog on a walk, you know, just do something like after I eat, because that helps control the, you know, better.
Is there even a leash small enough for Jackie? She's very, very petite little dog.
She is a tiny. No, she. Yeah, she has a little body harness and she wears, and she barks at everybody, and then they come up to her, and she hides behind me.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. All bark and no bite, literally.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's so funny. I took her over to a friend's house yesterday, and she was like walking around sniffing, and then she'd bark at somebody. I'd yell at her, and she'd be like, "Okay."
Oh my god.
I'll just walk around still.
Yeah. By the way, just real quickly, before we wrap this up, any of you guys seen the documentary Downloaded?
No, never heard of it.
No.
Oh, it's about the rise and fall of Napster.
Oh, I'd like to see that, just because I remember all that
shit. It's on Netflix, so I watched it last night.
I think I did watch it like a few months ago when it first dropped on Netflix.
Right, right.
Forgot all about it, yeah.
Yeah, it was... It was okay, but there's a lot of self-congratulatory, theme running throughout the whole documentary. It was done by Alex Winter as well, if that's any...
Yeah, I did really watch that.
Yeah, he did it.
I watched it a while back.
Yeah, yeah. It's good. I mean, they speak to all the Napster guys. They talk about how it all started, and I didn't know that Napster was actually the nickname of Sean Fanning on the IRC rooms, you know, the international or internet... fucking whatever you call them, chat rooms. That was his nickname, his handle there, Napster. I had no idea. But, so they speak to him, they speak to Sean Parker and all the other guys involved with it, and just show them where they were working out of for Napster. It was like just a shithole of a place. Just a nothing place. But it was good. And they talk about what they did afterwards. I had no idea that Sean Parker was responsible for Spotify. I didn't know that. Yeah, so he's... He's made a few bucks, that's for damn sure, over the years, with that and Facebook. And
he's also the Facebook guy that Timberlake did,
Yeah. But it's worth watching. I mean, I gave it a 3 out of 5. I thought it was okay. Certainly worth your time, you know, 100 and I'll something minutes. Yeah, like I said, it's on Netflix, so you can catch it there. But you guys got any films or docos you're looking forward to in the break we have over the next 4 weeks or so?
Goodness, that's a good question.
Have you seen Creed yet, Hunter? I know John has.
I did see Creed.
Okay, you have seen
it. I saw it yesterday.
Okay.
And we'll do an episode on it.
Yeah, we'll do it. It'll be early next year, obviously, with this one being the last one for the iTunes feed and the website and Stitcher and all that, but not the last one at all, because we do that other one that we have recorded. It's all done. It's all in the can and ready to go. And the date of release for that will be December 15th.
Okay. So check the website, and if you want, this is the Return of Garrow show.
It is.
So Garrow is back. He's been away due to illness, and we'll talk in depth about that. We talk about a lot of stuff, It's
a free form conversation. There's no topic.
It is a free form conversation, and it's, you know, if you're easily offended, maybe don't listen. But it's a paid episode, and if you're a fan of Garrow's appearances on this show, it's going to be worth paying for.
It will. Yeah. So that'll be out December 15th. Now,
yeah.
The day before that, or a day or two before that, December 13th or 14th, around there, on the feed, there will be an information piece from myself or all three of us or two of us or just myself. We'll sort it out between us who's doing it, telling you where to go and all the details of how to get it, okay, and how it works. So you won't get lost in the dark. There will be a post up on the website. There'll be the Facebook posts all over Twitter. It'll be all over that. And there'll be a little 5-minute piece on the feed as well telling you how you can buy that episode. It is strictly donation only. It'll never, ever, ever be released. It won't be like, oh, we're missing a week, so let's put out that paid. No, you can only ever get it through buying it. As we said, we
can't have it on iTunes.
We really can't.
I don't think we could, no. But, I mean, it'll never be released in the future as a free episode anywhere. So, yeah, you can only get it through donation. The episode is $2. Again, that will be reiterated in the short piece that is released a couple of days before, telling you where you can get it. If you want to donate more, hey, it's all good. We'd appreciate it. It all comes towards us getting 2,000.
It all comes towards the show.
It does. Like, it really does. Yeah. It all comes to us going to our server saying, hey, for 2016, we're paying a year in advance. Here you go.
Yeah, it's all just to pay for the show's expenses. It's nobody's getting rich off this thing.
there's no Aristotle Onassis type parties being thrown from the money we're in from this.
No, that would be cool if there was, though.
It would be nice. Yeah. I mean, if we could just get a whole bunch of chicks to come along to a big MMC party and, we promise we won't bring Charlie Sheen, so you'll be all right.
Yeah. Nobody will be getting life will give us lemons and we won't make lemonades out of it.
Oh.
The lemonades.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, the joke. Right? It's not the yeah, wow, okay. It's like, no, I'm not paying for no fucking episode now. Go get it out. So yeah, that's a deal. Okay. Everything will go back into the show. Our server will get paid. Our domain name re-registration will get paid. Anything else left after that gets split between us. We go out and buy new equipment and stuff.
It'll be go to equipment. Like, yeah. It's none of it's going to be go to hookers and blow. They'll definitely be nice.
Yeah, none of that. No, all back into the show. So, yeah. Keep an ear out and an eye out for the information coming with that. We promise you will, you'll have all that at your disposal some way or another. You'll know about it. So that'll be that. The show itself runs around about 2 hours 25, so 2.5. Yep. It's around there. It's a fairly lengthy show. It's not a 60-minute thing like we usually do or have been doing lately. You got to get some bang for your buck. And, of course, the most important thing, Garrow's back. And he does
about his illness.
Yeah, let's say he does a lot of talking, of talking. So
I learned a lot about chemo.
Yeah,
there you go. That's the only snippet of information.
That's the teaser.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, that's us done on the feed and the website for 2016 and Stitcher and everything else like that. For 2015. Sorry, I'm a year ahead of myself. It's bad enough. I'm already a day ahead of these guys. I'm now a year ahead of everyone else. Well, all right. So that's it for us. We will be back in 2016 in about mid-January time, something like that. We're just going to take about a month off, just cool the engines a bit and have a break, spend time with families and loved ones and whatnot, and see in the new year and shit. And
check out phantomsway.com. Check us out over there.
Check us out on phantomsway.com. Yeah. They've been very kind to us, putting us out there every week. Lately, it has been a mixture of new shows and older ones, like some retreads in there. As of next year, we've got plans in place, which we're not going to announce just yet. But if you do get us via Phantom Sway, you'll be getting our newer shows a lot more frequently than you will be a mixture of old and new. Okay? So that's good. So everybody who's listened, everybody who spent their precious time listening to us, interacting with us, it's much appreciated from myself and the guys. And with that, I'll say sign off, lads.
Adios.
Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.
Yeah.